You're listening to Season 2, Episode 27 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. Their MFA writing program has been around for 35 years. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low-residency writing programs in the country. Guess what, guys? I'm so excited about today's new episode because we have one of the most grounded human beings on the show, Matt De La Peña. He just so happens to be the 2016 Newbery Medal winning author of Last Stop on Market Street. His book is also a 2016 Caldecott Honor Book, a 2016 Coretta Scott King Illustrator Honor Book, a New York Times Book Review Notable Children's Book of 2015, and a Wall Street Journal Best Children's Book. In today's episode, Matt shares his personal stories about creative and personal growth, and we unpack what it means to be present and live in the moment. How our experiences and honesty in our work create vibrancy, pacing ourselves to avoid writer's block, the impact of having mentors, and so much more. Let's jump right in. Hey everyone, I'm so excited to have our special guest with us on the show today. Matt, what's up? How are you?
Hey, it's great to be on your show.
You're in Brooklyn right now. That's pretty awesome. You've been there for 11 years?
Been here 11 years. I planned on being here for two. Everything kind of went to the wayside and I've stayed.
We miss you here over in San Diego, but you will be coming out soon.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to teach at San Diego State for the spring semester. I'm going to live near the beach in Solana Beach and I get to miss a New York winter.
I'd love to kick it off. You actually have a really interesting story about reading and writing.
I feel like I'm the opposite of many author friends I have who kind of got into writing through reading. So they were readers first, and then they were like, hey, let me give this a shot myself. Me, I think it was the opposite. I actually got into reading through writing. When I was in middle school and high school, I used to do a lot of spoken word poetry that I never showed anyone, but I was really into the music I could make with words and sentences. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of depth there because I wasn't a reader and I was a young person, just kind of figuring things out. But then I got to college and I started to read other spoken word artists for the first time and eventually discovered books. For me, it was like diverse literature that made me fall in love with books, whereas I didn't find that stuff in high school too much. We were reading the canon.
Do you remember if there was one specific fiction that basically changed your life and made you love fiction?
I think the first book that I fell in love with was House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. And, you know, that was one book that I did read in high school. I probably read that book 12 times. And I remember thinking, you know, why should I read these other books? This one's just fine. So I kept reading it over and over. And then I got to college and the book that really grabbed me, it was the first novel. I think House on Mango Street is kind of more of a collection of vignettes. Mm-hmm. But the first novel was The Color Purple. I love that book.
Yeah.
And it moved me. And I wanted to read more books that would make me feel things like that.
Yeah, I love that you brought up House on Mango Street because we actually had Jacqueline Woodson on the show too. And she was, I think, the first and probably aside from you, the only one who mentioned that book. And I love that you brought it up. Okay, so the book in college, you were saying, was it something that you stumbled upon in class or did a teacher mention it to you, recommend it to you? How did that come about?
Yeah, so it was a professor who I had had my freshman year. She approached me in the middle of campus. I wasn't in her class anymore, but for some reason, she thought I needed to read The Color Purple. So she was like, you know, I was rereading this book last night and I thought of you. And she gave me the book and she's like, you don't have to take a test on the book. You don't have to write an essay. Just promise me you'll finish it before you graduate. And I don't think at that point I'd ever had one specific book recommended to me by a teacher or a librarian. So it was a new experience. And I think the reason she gave it to me is because I was kind of expressing, I guess, a little bit of disappointment in the way I grew up without money And I was thinking I had a really tough life. And I think she gave it to me as a way of saying, hey, you know what? There are people out there who have had tougher lives than you. Mm. And it was the right book for the right time.
Did you ever circle back and reach out to the teacher or let her know your thoughts about the book after you finished it and how she made an impact on your life?
Yeah, I did. We ended up talking quite a bit about the book when I was in college. She ended up being kind of a mentor to me. Yeah, circling back years and years later, she's now a president of a small college in Northern California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I recently went there as a guest speaker. So it was kind of cool that I got to tell that story to all her students.
I bet she was so proud.
Yeah, it was great. It was really cool. I think it was moving to her.
I know that you are half Mexican, half white. You didn't grow up speaking Spanish, did you?
That's true. You know, here's the thing. The way I grew up, I was surrounded by Spanish all the time. So it's not like I didn't understand Spanish, but I never grew up speaking it. Therefore, I was always ashamed of my Spanish. It was the color around me. I grew up around Spanish, Mexican food, my Mexican side of my family, because my mom, she didn't really have a family, so, and she's the white side. So I pretty much was raised by the Mexican side of my family. So even though I don't speak Spanish, I sort of understand it. I just don't speak it, if that makes sense. And you know, my understanding isn't great, but it's just kind of like the color that surrounded me when I was growing up. And now I have a daughter. I'm hoping that I can teach her Spanish by learning it myself.
Oh, that'd be so cute if you learn together.
I know, right?
It's interesting because my mom is from Malaysia. She's Chinese Malaysian. My dad is Taiwanese. And my mom speaks fluent English. So she learned Mandarin after meeting and marrying my dad.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I grew up in a very, very non-ethnic neighborhood. And I got bullied a lot. So I was actually embarrassed that I was able to speak Chinese. And Chinese was actually my first language. And then I was sent to ESL to learn English. And then I purposely blocked out all the Chinese. And I actually forgot how to speak Chinese. So when you mentioned that you were ashamed of your Spanish, you were talking about your ability to speak Spanish, not that you were ashamed to want to learn Spanish or to speak Spanish, right?
You know what? It was more that I was ashamed of my inability to speak Spanish. Because where I grew up, when I would go to family gatherings, my favorite uncles, they would tell a story that would start in English and move into Spanish for the rest of it. So I feel like every punchline is in Spanish. And then when I would tell a story, it would be strictly in English. And that was shameful to me because these are my people, my favorite uncles in the world, but I couldn't go to that part of their world. So I was more ashamed of not speaking Spanish in front of them. Where I grew up, you know, I lived in two communities in San Diego. The first one was predominantly Mexican, like I'd say like 95%. And then I moved up north a little bit and it was more of a mix. It was probably 50-50. I never was ashamed of being Mexican. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest shame I felt was feeling not Mexican enough. And it's because it was Southern California and there's such a big Mexican presence.
In my community, it was like, you're different. But then after high school, college, I was like, fuck that. I want to learn Chinese. And I just put all my effort in it. And now I can speak Mandarin again. And I've even picked up some of Taiwanese for my dad.
Oh, that's great.
It's a great closure for me. And just being super proud of your culture. And I love hearing that for you. Was there ever opportunities for you to ask family members, what does this mean? And to try to pick it up?
Oh, yeah. You know what? It was mostly you get it through osmosis. So you're just there. You're in the presence of these Spanglish conversations. And you just sort of pick up what's going on. You put it together for yourself. So when I went to Spanish class, I took Spanish all through high school. That was a different Spanish. It wasn't the Spanish of the street. It was the Spanish of the textbook. You know, there were a lot of similarities, of course, but there were many, many differences like Spanish slang and Spanish cursing. And by the way, I feel very happy that you just dropped an F-bomb. I didn't know this was an F-bomb free zone.
It is your zone. It is a safe zone. It's all good.
That's awesome. But you know what? I think growing up mixed, it's a confusing place to be. Now the demographic has changed of our country. Young people, there are so many mixed kids. But I think back then, nobody talked about it. I guess you're navigating situations that you can't talk to other people about, including your parents. My dad was full Mexican, my mom was full white, so I can't ask them what it's like to be mixed because I'm the first one, me and my two sisters. So I think growing up, the biggest thing about being mixed is sometimes you don't feel white enough to be down with the white kids and you don't feel Mexican enough to be down with the Mexican kids. So it's a confusing place to be. And I think the journey is to realize that, hey, it's kind of cool to be able to float between worlds. It's actually an advantage, not a disadvantage.
Were you bullied while growing up?
A little bit when I was in elementary school, mostly because I'm pretty light-skinned. Mm-hmm. And so people would assume that I was more well-off, you know, just because I was lighter skinned. So that was kind of, so it was more from the Mexican crowd, which is kind of complicated.
What about carrying into middle school and high school when people had more of an understanding that the lightness of your color doesn't mean your economic status?
When I got to junior high and high school, I literally disappeared from the social world. Oh. So I was like one of these guys who never went to parties, never did anything like that. And what I did is I sort of sunk into the dream I had at the time, which was I wanted to be the first in my family to go to college. And I knew the only way I was going to get there was by way of a basketball scholarship. So I began just playing basketball like crazy. So it kind of, in a weird way, it saved me from all the social stuff that people have to navigate because I was a basketball player. I had a few friends. I always had a girlfriend, and that's pretty much it. I never went to parties, never did anything like that. So I feel basketball shielded me from a lot.
I guess academics wasn't really your strong suit.
Yeah, I was a very mediocre student, you know, like a 2.9.
Gotcha.
3.0 student, which isn't bad, but it's not going to get you free money for school. So I knew it wasn't going to be like an academic path, but I was pretty good at basketball. And I had played with some older kids that I saw got scholarships. And I was like, I wonder if I could ever do that. So yeah, I kind of targeted that as like my way out of the neighborhood.
How did your parents feel about that? Were they always very supportive about going to college? Or was that kind of your own thing that you want to do by yourself?
I think my mom was very supportive. I think my dad didn't really understand the idea of college. And I think what he was most, I guess there was friction between us, is he was such a hardworking man, quiet, hardworking Mexican father. And here he saw me playing all day, every day. And I think for him, it was like, you know, here's this kid. He's my child and he's not working. He's not working with his hands. He's playing a game. I think it didn't really register for him that basketball was a path until I was in college. And then he was like, you know what? I get it now. I think the thing about my dad is he was a teenage father. So, you know, he had no chance to pursue his own education. And he was kind of a drifter too, self-admittedly. We call him the hippie Mexican surfer guy because he really loved surfing, which was very rare for a Mexican guy.
That's so cool.
Yeah. He got a job when he was like 17 years old because he had a kid. And then from that point on, he just worked. Never saw him read, never saw him pursue anything academic. But sometimes it takes something tragic to pull you out of your comfort zone and make you look at the world again and see if there are any other possible avenues. So he got fired from this job that he had worked for 26 years.
Oh my God.
And it was devastating. He lost his identity. And so he was unemployed for 2 years and didn't know what to do. And he was a man of great pride. So, you know, in the working class world, I think men don't know what to do with shame and vulnerability. So he became a very silent person that just didn't want people to look at him. And then, you know, I was in graduate school at this time and I'm reading everything. One day he just asked me if he could read the book that I had just finished. And I was like, this is weird. You know, I can't believe he wants to read a book. It was 100 Years of Solitude by Marquez. And I was like, man, this guy can't start with that. He needs to start with some Dr. Seuss. You can't just jump into magical realism, but you also can't tell your dad that. So I gave him the book and it took him, I think, 6 months before he finished it. But he really liked the book. And he asked me if he could read all the books that I was reading. He started to kind of go down this path of reading for the first time. And I think it gave him a different identity. And then he ended up going to get his GED. He ended up getting his AA degree. And then he ended up getting his BA at UC Santa Cruz years later in literature. He saw a new path through literature. And now he's a third grade teacher. He teaches in Spanish.
Dude, that's amazing. I had the biggest smile on my face. Thank you for sharing that. Right before your dad asked you to read the book, was he totally gung-ho that you were getting your master's, was it?
Yeah.
Was he totally for that? Was he more like, why are you not in the work field yet?
I feel lucky because my dad, I think once I went to college and he saw that I was in positions that I never would have been otherwise. So my parents, they supported education pretty quickly. And then when I went to graduate school, they were kind of into it. I mean, my dad didn't really talk about it, but he wasn't anti-school. I go to schools all over the country now and I see kids that are like me, Mexican fathers and growing up in that culture. And the thing about Mexican culture, you know, not across the board, but there's a big percentage of the culture that is kind of promoting hard work and loyalty and not so much aspiration. I think there's a huge guilt that a lot of Mexican kids feel for going off to college because they're not helping the family that's struggling, and now they're off having fun at college and they feel incredibly guilty. And as a matter of fact, I recently read that Hispanics have the highest dropout rate in college. And I think a big part of it is there's a guilt that some people feel for not being home, not being loyal, not being present. So actually the book I'm finishing up right now, I'm revising it, is about that guilt. So it's about a kid who's the first in his family to go to college and he feels incredibly guilty for succeeding. I think it's something that nobody talks about. In other cultures, living in Brooklyn, I'm very close with people of many different cultures. And for example, I know this Chinese girl whose the message growing up was go to college, no matter what, go to college. You know, it's like succeed, aspire. So there are different messages within different immigrant communities, which is fascinating to me. So I get to meet a lot of kids on the road, obviously, because I'm in schools. And you know, it's very interesting to see kids and the way they define themselves. So this kid, Joshua in San Antonio, you know, I was told that he was a troublemaker. He's going to be in the back of the auditorium. He's not going to last. He's going to get kicked out because he's, you know, he's always going to mess with somebody. And it was true. He was like smacking some kid in the back of the head when I was talking. And I was like, I love to like try to get that kid interested because if I can get that kid, then I have the whole crowd. So, you know, I was kind of like targeting him. And as I started talking about the way I grew up and my culture, he started to listen. And by the end of it, he was super, super engaged. And he approached me afterwards and said, you know, I don't really talk about this, but I was born in a prison and I identify with so many things that you said. I've actually been held back twice. I shouldn't even be here. And basically he was saying like, I'm acting out because I'm embarrassed to be here. I'm ashamed. But then he wanted to give me a piece of his writing because he told me he wrote about San Antonio gangs. And he gave it to me and I really kind of forgot about it for a while. And then when I read it, I was blown away. His writing was so visceral and real and the language was fantastic. And so it kind of made me think about the way kids define themselves. He would never go to the teachers at a school and say, I write. He's more comfortable with the definition of being a screw up or the tough kid. It's like a way to protect his ego. But then here was a writer who came in. It was almost like he had to admit to me that he was a writer. Imagine all the great writing that's being done secretly by people who are ashamed to share it. And so he's a great example of that.
Yeah, no one in the school, the principal or the teachers would ever expect him to whip that out. That's a heartbreaking thing.
It is.
Is that people judge you by how you look and how you behave and think that correlates with what you have inside of you. And that's a damn shame.
And isn't it kind of the way, you know, like the stuff in the news right now with the friction between the police and Black Americans, you know, like, that's what it's all about.
It's so important. If you're going to be interacting and immersing yourself in a community that's different than yours, you better get assimilated and understand the culture before you start making judgments. That's always the cause of issues. There was this video of this cop. She was filming herself talking. Oh, I just wish I knew her name so I could give her credit. I'll mention it in the show notes page. She was saying how she got into a lot of trouble growing up and she felt like she was a total screw up. And then something happened. She changed and made a promise to protect the community, the neighborhood, and to do her best to help others who were in her same shoes. She became a cop. To see that video of Alton and Philando to get shot, murdered, cold blood like that. Yeah. Oh, she was fucking furious. She's like, that is shameful for the cops to even be wearing those uniforms. Take it off. Take it off. If you can't understand our people, and my God, I could have not agreed more.
And I think what's fascinating is this is the power of reading, because if you read a book that's features a kid like Joshua. You get to read the inside of his heart. You get to read the inside of his brain. And when you normally interact with a kid like that, all you see is the hood and the mischief. The reason I think reading is so powerful is it creates this pocket where you can have true empathy because you get to see the whole being. And that's why actually one of my biggest things as a writer is to try to get those kind of tough kids like Joshua to read too, because they're going to understand the world in a deeper way if they read, you know? So
yeah, and being able to relate to the character too.
Exactly. You know, I think growing up in a working class environment, you are taught, especially as a boy, to not have feelings, to not have emotions. That's a problem because then, you know, like if you get in a little friction with another person on the street or a girlfriend, you don't have the language to express yourself and you think you can't show weakness. And that creates huge problems. So I feel like the power of reading is giving those kids like a place to feel things they don't normally get to feel.
Were you able to ever check back with Josh?
You know what? I wish I did. I did try because this happened a while ago. You know, unfortunately, this kid had left the school. It was a junior high that I was at. So he had left the school and nobody knew where he was. Last I heard, I think he moved from San Antonio to Houston or something, but I totally lost track of him.
You know what? For that moment, he was able to share that secret with you, and I'm sure that is already life-changing for him.
Exactly, exactly.
Through your work, I know you like to add very diverse characters, which is what I love about your work. And of course, you won 2016's Newbery Medal for Last Stop on Market Street. What inspired you to write that story?
There were a couple things kind of bouncing around my head, and mostly I was thinking, hey, how can this fit into a YA novel? I think one of the biggest things that I was thinking about is when I go to the poor schools to do a visit, it really breaks my heart when a kid, and this happens quite a bit, a kid will look at me kind of on the down low and say, "Mister, why would you come here?" In other words, our school is not worthy. We're not worthy of having an author or a guest. And that breaks my heart. I never hear that at private schools. Wealthy schools. Yeah. So why do these kids think they're not deserving? And so I was like, you know what? How can I approach this in a YA novel? The more I thought about it, the more I thought, I wonder if this would be a better vehicle for this would be a picture book. Just this idea of what's worthy, who's worthy, feeling worthy. In this book, a lot of people, when they describe the book, they're like, well, the grandmother's teaching her grandson how to see the world as beautiful. But the way I wrote it, the way I see it still, is I think the grandmother's using this kid's surrounding to teach him how to see himself as beautiful. And it just seemed to be a good fit for a picture book. What blows me away and is very exciting is that I think 5 years ago, that book comes out. It's super quiet. A few people really like it. And you know, it sort of, it fades. But I think right now, the population is changing so much. The readers are changing. The people in power are changing. And they want to celebrate a story that features kids of color. And it's so exciting to me.
Seeing your book winning the Newbery Medal, it gave me a lot of hope.
It's very, very powerful to see yourself in a book. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you have a place in art, you know?
Yeah.
But the way I look at it is, I feel like it's even more powerful to see yourself in a book that has a bunch of shiny ass stickers on it. You know what I mean? So that's what I love about the Newbery. It's like, wow, book has been validated by the canon, you know?
That's so important for people to see that. Diversity matters, you know?
Yeah.
That's the end line.
Well, and also you doing this podcast. This is important.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I do appreciate that. Last Stop on Market Street. I know that we talk about diversity, but also in a more, I guess, spiritual aspect. Your book, too, the way Nana's talking to her grandson, CJ, it's like Ralph Waldo Emerson's quote, "Life is a journey, not a destination." Do you know that quote?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's very much appreciate what it is that's going on right now in the present instead of the final end result that so many people, everybody's guilty of doing. We're always like, ah, man, I got to get this done. Man, I can't wait till this. I can't wait till that trip. I can't. All right. Hold up. What about this second? What do you appreciate right now? And then I think that's what Nana also instills in her grandson, not only seeing the beauty of everything, but also in the moment, reminding him of the present.
Being present.
Absolutely being present. Is there anyone in your life specifically that reminds you or inspired the character Nana?
I had a grandmother that was the matriarch of our family. She was from Tijuana. You know, she worked when she was 14. She had 3 kids by the time she was 16. So she was that kind of woman. She also spent most of her life working in an elementary school cafeteria. She was just a working class Mexican woman. Spanish was her first language, but she could speak English. She had a kind of a pretty good accent. But the thing about her, she was like a silent presence. So she didn't say much, but she had this wisdom. One of the things that got me is no matter what I did, if I did something good or if I did something bad, she would always have the same response. She'd come up to me. She wouldn't say one word. She would just pat me on the knee and look at me. So if I got in trouble with my dad and got kicked out of my house, she'd come up to me and she'd pat me on the knee and look at me. If I did something really good, like I got a basketball scholarship, she'd come up to me. She wouldn't praise me. She'd just pat me on the knee and look at me. And I think she is one of the sources of inspiration for Nana. And in a weird way, my dad is too. Like he very rarely talks, but sometimes when he says things, he has a slightly different way of seeing the world. It's a little street. It's not always beautiful or refined, but it's
real.
It's philosophically valid, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's real. It's organic. It's thoughtful. So I would say those two. And then the illustrator grew up with his grandmother too, and I got to meet her. So when I was doing the book, those were the 3 people that I sort of thought of in the back of my head.
I bet the illustrator was blown away and so excited.
Well, his grandmother, she calls it her book.
That's so cute.
Which is so cool.
Did you actually find the illustrator yourself, or did you get matched up with the illustrator and by chance the illustrator so happened to have an awesome grandma?
The illustrator and I share the same agent. This whole project was kind of the master plan of our agent, who's just an incredible agent. By the way, he lives in San Diego.
Oh, who's your agent?
His name is Stephen Malk.
Is he independent or he has his own company?
He works for Writer's House, but they allow him to work out of San Diego. And he's incredible. He works with just tremendous illustrators and authors. But so he matched us up. And one of the first things I saw was an old picture that the illustrator had done of him and his grandmother. And so I kind of like thought of those two when I was writing the book. I got really lucky. I got to actually meet his grandmother before the book was done. So I kind of could tinker with the book with her in mind.
That's really rare. I feel like I've never heard that story before, ever.
Super rare.
No wonder she says it's her book. I mean, I would say the same thing. Damn, that's awesome. What about the actual conversations between Nana and CJ? Was there a memory from your childhood in particular that perhaps inspired the conversation between them? Or maybe is it conversations between you and your daughter?
I think it was more of just the concept of, you know, young people, they're inundated with so many commercials and messages that are telling them what to want. You know, that's the one bummer about America. You know, capitalism. It's like, you should buy this, you should buy this, you should buy this, eat here. And I was like, you know what? That kind of makes me sad. And it's like, what about the other narrative, which is seeing the power and the beauty of what you already have? So it was more of a dance. To me, it wasn't really thinking back to a memory. It was more of like, I want to write a dance, a musical dance between a grandmother and a grandson. I wish I had this. Oh, but you're looking at it wrong. Look at that you already have this. And so it was kind of that dance through the whole book. And then, you know, I really liked this Nana. I started to think, you know what? I want to give her one line of ultimate power. To me, the line that sort of sums up everything is when she says, sometimes when you're surrounded by dirt, CJ, you're a better witness for what's beautiful. And I think that is the wisdom of her character that comes out more overtly at that point.
When you're talking about the lyrical dance, it reminds me of when you mentioned that you started off with more spoken word.
Yeah.
Spoken word is very lyrical. And sure. I wonder if it's just like almost tying it back to that.
Well, listen, what you're saying right now is 100% true. People ask me, hey, is it hard to go from a novel to writing a picture book? And I'm like, actually, it's in a weird way, it's like going home. Because when I write a picture book, I don't think of the pictures. I don't have to do that. All I have to do is write a spoken word poem and give it to somebody, you know, and then they do the other stuff. So to me, it's no different than the poems I was writing when I was in high school.
This actually reminds me also, when you were saying that you were doing mostly poems and spoken word, when was that jump, if you remember?
I think what happened is my poems were getting too long to be poems.
Okay.
They were like 7-page poems. And then I was like, God, you know what? Maybe I should try a short story. And I was reading short story collections at the time, so I was kind of imitating, you know, writers. And then my short stories were becoming like 25 pages. And I was like, wow, would I ever write a novel? And so at that point, I thought maybe I would one day do it. And then, of course, I'm reading novels and I'm like, wow, there's such a power in following a character for 300 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, let me give it a shot. And it's a really different medium, writing a novel. It's so different. The biggest thing is you don't get that immediate gratification that you get in a poem. In a poem, you can finish a poem in a week and feel pretty good about the language. In a novel, it takes a year. You just have to be more patient with the novel because it's a journey. And a poem, you know, you can knock it out. So that's the biggest challenge, I think, for me.
How do you think you've evolved creatively?
I used to write about race. Like, I have this book called Mexican White Boy, and it's really about being mixed. That's really the focus of the story. So I think I've evolved a little bit, and now my focus of the story isn't the diverse aspect, but it still features diverse characters. I call it Diversity 2.0. It's a story featuring diverse characters that are in a plot that's not overtly about diversity. So that's one way. Another way I think I've evolved is, I think when I was writing my early novels, I really wrote sentences that were of the street. They were very, very gritty, lots of slang, broken English. And I still do a little bit of that, but now I kind of pulled back on that a little bit.
Was it a conscious choice, or it was just like a gradual, okay.
Originally, I liked having this cool mix of broken, dirty sentences.
Like raw, like a feeling raw, of raw.
Raw, okay. Is a great word. Raw prose mixed with this sort of street intelligence of my characters. But then as I got into the process a little bit longer and longer and longer, I wanted to refine the characters slightly. So they're still of the street and they're still of those kind of neighborhoods, but now they at least have the ability, they don't always do it, but they have the ability to write beautiful or to talk beautiful. There was a vignette in House on Mango Street that taught me a lot. It's called Darius in the Clouds, and it's a very quick little vignette. This kid, he's kind of a thug. He's a little, you know, like, I don't know, sixth grade or something. He's the kid who chases girls with a stick that had touched a rat, like that kind of kid, right? At one point at the end, he points at the clouds and he goes, "Do you guys see that cloud up there?" And everybody's like, "Yeah, you know, like why? Why are you talking about that?" And he's like, "That cloud is God." He makes it simple. And it's like, wow, you know what? The author gave that kid, that scrubby kid, she gave him poetry. And so I've always like wanted to give my characters poetry. But now I think I want to be able to go in and out of those raw sections of prose. I like the idea of being able to have more range.
You were very much an artist. You just like to explore your mediums. Do you ever hit writer's block? Is that ever something that hinders you throughout all your works that you've written? Or is it not a thing for you?
I think we all have days where the stuff just isn't happening. You know, I mean, it's not coming. We all have so many of those days. But I think writer's block specifically is a confusing idea that covers so many different problems. The biggest one that I would want to talk about right now is, I think sometimes writer's block is a function of looking at the big picture too soon. So in other words, you're on chapter 4, you're working through a scene, and you're blocked because you're actually thinking, well, what does the whole book mean? What is it going to do? I'm trying to write this one sentence, but I'm thinking about the entire theme of the book. That to me is writer's block. It's like you're getting in the way of what you're really supposed to be doing, which is just writing that single sentence. So I try to keep it simple. In a way, I think it pays off to be somebody who's simple. You don't have these grand visions of writing the great American novel. It's like, no, you know what? Today, I'm going to get my character from the living room to the back porch. That's all my job is today. If I keep that mindset, that simple mindset, why would I ever have writer's block? There's no way I would. But if I start to think like, how does that fit into the grand theme of the novel? I might be blocked.
Do you think it would also work if people have the mentality of being meticulous in focusing on the smaller details?
Absolutely.
Rather than magnifying what it is that they're writing at the moment. When you are meticulous, you're combing through every little thing so that you don't even have time to think about the bigger picture.
Well, and it goes back to something something you said earlier about Last Supper on Market Street. Part of the message of the story you were saying is that it's about being in the moment. And I think as a writer, you have to be in the moment. You have to be in the scene that you're writing, in the sentence that you're writing, in the word you're searching for. I always tell people, I don't even know what my books are about until I finish them. And then you go, oh my God, I see what I'm doing. And now I have to revise the whole book to make sense. But if you start to try to figure out what the book is about before you're done with the book, you're more likely to be blocked, I believe.
What's your proudest moment in your career? I know it's difficult, but try to pinpoint one.
Well, in terms of books, I think it was seeing my book in a bookstore for the first time. That was so overwhelming because I never actually thought I could do it. I loved writing, but I didn't think people published books like mine. Like, I just didn't think that was possible because the books that I was, you know, exposed to in graduate school, they were all like highfalutin, important, big word books. But then I read Junot Diaz, Drown. He had a story collection called Drown. And it was in a similar voice with similar characters. And I was like, wow, they published this? So that was the first time I thought, hey, maybe I could publish a book. But then when I saw it in the bookstore, like, it was probably the most proud I've ever been of myself. Because it's such a journey. It's hard to get a book out there. A little less self-involved was I had one of my books, Mexican White Boy, was banned in Arizona. It just got caught up in this political thing where there was a program. Our student body is like 85% Mexican American. Let's maybe try to motivate these Mexican students by exposing them to Mexican authors and Mexican characters. So it was a really cool program, and Mexican White Boy was one of the books they used. But then the program got stripped away for political reasons, and they actually took Mexican White Boy out of the kids' hands while they were reading it in one class and put it in a box and put it in the basement. And it was no longer legal in that school to have that book. And I ended up speaking at that very school a year later. And I think one of my proudest moments was that I was able to use the speaking fee to buy Mexican White Boy copies for every single kid who had it taken out of their hands. So it was like one of those weird moments where being an author was about more than just being an author.
Yeah, it was about giving back and actually adding movement.
Yes, yes.
I remember reading that. It was such a beautiful moment too, when that student, was her name Anna?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anna reached out to you, and imagine what you were able to do for her in her eyes. You're her hero.
And I think she was a hero in the eyes of her fellow students because she brought me to their school.
That's like total street cred right there.
Yeah, totally.
Your college professor who gave you that book, she sort of became your mentor. So how important do you think it is to have a mentor in your life for your career and your life overall?
In a weird way, it's like reading a book. It's you're reading people. You're reading people that you admire. You're trying to see the world through their eyes. So when she gave me The Color Purple, I was like, huh, why did she give this to me? I want to figure out why. So of course I read the book with that in mind. I think for me as a writer, I have mentors that I've never even met. There are some writers that I admire so much that I read their books, not just for the story, but to see what they are doing. How did they do this? So they become mentors to me. And then I have other mentors in the book world, that one of them is Linda Sue Park, who is mostly a middle grade novelist. She won the Newbery in the early 2000s. She sat me down when I only had one book and said, hey, look, if you're going to do this as a career, make sure you do this, this, and this, and things that I'd never even considered. So I think it's really, really powerful to be open to mentorship. And you don't even need to know your mentors all the time. You just can kind of like be mentored by osmosis or just by observation.
Okay, so when you said Linda sat you down and told you to do this, this, and this, were those the best advice that you've ever received in your writing career?
I think they were, because they came at the right time. The biggest thing is, she's like, schools are going to start to come to you and ask you to speak at their schools. You know, this is how it goes. This is what you could talk about. Those are things I had never even considered. And she was right. That started happening.
Wow.
She also told me, creatively, don't try to take on too many contracts at once because it becomes overwhelming. And she was right about that. You know, so I think she sat me down at the perfect time where I just was ignorant and naive to all of those things. And I just listened. Like, I think it's very important for writers to listen, because I think what we do is we're talking all the time when we're writing. Like, we're telling the story. But I think it's as important to not talk and listen to the people who are already doing it, or to the people who are giving you feedback on your piece. Just listen. You don't have to always agree, but it's very powerful to listen.
I love that Linda basically saved you all that stress from
so
all
true.
Those contracts, and also helped you with talking points for your school talk. What are some small, manageable steps that you'd advise to writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goal?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you will never finish a book if you don't write the book. So I think sitting down in the chair every single day is so important. Never taking a day off. Even if one day you have so much other stuff going on, you at least sit down and review what you have written already or write two sentences, maybe give it 10 minutes, but at least every single day you are gaining ground. I think that's the biggest thing. You just continue to gain ground. Another thing is, a lot of people don't realize this, but reading might be one of the most important things you can do. I always tell people you can never even be a good writer unless you're first a great reader. Because this is the fuel for what we do. You're reading to like see what other people are doing and how they're doing it. You're also reading to see what not to do with a bad book. You're also reading outside your comfort zone to be exposed to things that maybe are brand new to you. Like, oh my gosh, this book is using the epistolary form. How does that work? How does it function? So reading, not just for story, but reading for process too.
Are you a believer in writing prompts? And is that something that you've ever used for yourself?
You know, I don't do writer's prompts, but I definitely write outside of the novel. Like sometimes I'll write a scene that I know is not going to be in the book, but it helps me understand the character's mindset in a different scene. I call it writing outside of the book. It's not based on a prompt, but it is sort of, it serves a similar purpose. The one that I love to use with students, you know, people who are writing books, is I love to have their main character write a letter to me, not to them, but to me, telling me what that writer is doing right and what the writer is doing wrong. It's very helpful for writers to have their characters write about them. They've never thought of it that way. They're always thinking about their characters and how to manipulate their characters, but it's interesting to have the character write about you. It makes you see it in a new way, you know?
Oh, absolutely. What's your favorite topic to teach in colleges?
Two things. First one is simple. I love teaching dialogue because I think dialogue is one of the most important parts of a book.
Yep.
Just because, you know, you're going to know if the character's real or not based on how they talk. Another one, this is probably my favorite thing to teach, is what I call patience, literary patience. I think sometimes we as writers try to control too much of the story and we don't leave enough room for the reader. So I try to teach how to kind of facilitate more of a collaboration with your reader. And really what I'm getting at is you don't have to control everything in the book. You can trust your reader more than you think you can. You can leave more space than your instinct maybe tells you to leave. So I call it literary patience, but it kind of encapsulates a few different things. That's my favorite thing to teach.
Is that your ideal dream to write books while teaching, or do you want to maybe one day just focus solely on writing?
I mean, I think I spend probably 90% of my time just writing, but I love to keep a foot in the world of teaching.
Oh, that's cool.
Just because, you know, like there are some really great emerging writers today that I love to like be on the ground floor when they're finding their voice. I've seen a few writers where something clicks in and you're like, oh my God, you just figured it out. And it's cool. It's cool to witness that.
I always wrap up the episodes by asking if there's any books that guests recommend. And I know you mentioned quite a few awesome ones. Are there any other books that you'd like for us to check out?
I think there's one book that's often overlooked that people should really check out. It's called Inside Out and Back Again by Tang Ha. And it's about a Vietnamese character. I think people should really study Gary Schmidt's novels. He has one called Okay for Now, The Wednesday Wars. Those books are incredible. And then you know what? You mentioned Jackie Woodson earlier. She's my neighbor.
What?
So,
oh my God, yeah. She lives in Brooklyn too. Yes.
Yeah, she lives down the street and we hang out quite a bit. Brown Girl Dreaming, I think, is such an important work.
That wraps up our interview with the awesome Matt De La Pena. Matt, thank you again so much for being such an amazing guest on the show. I loved our chat. Listeners, I hope you're feeling warm and fuzzy after listening to Matt's episode. Thank you for joining our conversation, and please say hi to Matt over on Twitter at Matt De La Pena. Check out the important resources mentioned in his episode over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Matt De La Pena. One more thing before we wrap up Matt's episode. If you're a writer or a poet looking to publish your work, I encourage you to listen about today's sponsor. Vermont College of Fine Arts has two writing programs I'm so excited to tell you about. Their MFA in Writing is one of the original low residency programs, and frankly, one of the best in the country. Writers gather at VCFA's beautiful campus for two separate 10-day residencies each year. Imagine yourself immersed in a setting much like an intense writer's retreat where you're fully committed to workshops, lectures, and readings. After the residencies, you return home and work with a dedicated faculty advisor throughout the rest of the semester. The MFA in Writing and Publishing is VCFA's very first and brand new residential program that also focuses on improving your writing and giving you the tools to thrive in the arts. Every student learns directly from agents, editors, and publishers. The cool thing is that it's a cross-genre program, which means if you're a poet, you're encouraged to learn from faculty in fiction or nonfiction. Imagine yourself learning and creating in this incredible writing community, all while living on their gorgeous campus in Montpelier, Vermont. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA to learn more about these programs and their MFA in writing for children and young adults. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.